Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network.
Me?
No, the people behind
me. Oh,
you.
The listeners. Okay, yeah. Yes.
All right. Yes. Anyway, my name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. For the purposes of this particular podcast, you may call me Rockmeister McCool.
Yeah. It's the coolest name, man. And, yeah, this is the podcast where you write in, and we read your emails, and we talk about whatever you want us to talk about in your emails. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. box, if you're super interested in that. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Our P.O. box is Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah. So you can ask us questions. You can take us to task for things we said on our podcast. We disagree with the review we gave, for example. Anything at all, really. We're open books. Whitney, we don't like to dilly-dally at the front of these. We want to give people as much time as we possibly can, especially since we like to talk. Tell us about our first email.
Certainly, William.
Yes.
This is a letter from Starship. Hello, Starship.
Ooh, great name.
Dear sirs, first of all, the only thing I have to say about the 1993 Three Musketeers movie, which we reviewed recently, is Oliver Platt must have been exhausted from carrying the movie on his back. Oliver Platt is the only actor who's really bringing like a lot of verve and energy to that movie.
I'll correct you there. Tim Curry.
And Tim Curry.
Tim Curry's a good villain in that movie. But Oliver Platt is... Oliver Platt was not a particularly well-known character actor when The Three Musketeers came out. He'd been in stuff. People liked and respected him. But Three Musketeers was a lot of people's introduction to Oliver Platt. And he had Jack Sparrow energy like 15 years before Jack Sparrow was a thing.
Yeah, and he was like the Pirate King as well.
Yeah.
They reveal as a little twist at the end.
Yeah, he's absolutely delightful, and yeah, he totally carries that film.
Starship goes on. And now for my question. I know you guys get a lot of what's your favorite movie questions, and your awesome podcast, The Iron List, covers this as well.
Thank you.
But I'm curious about what your favorite episodes of TV are.
Oh, interesting.
Not your favorite shows, but specific episodes. Are there any episodes of any show that really stick in your mind as the best of what television has to offer from any show at any time?
Right.
I love movies, but when push comes to shove, I'm more of a TV fan. I love getting deep into characters episode after episode and getting to know the worlds that get built up around them. Thanks for all your hard work. I love your podcast. Sincerely, Starship.
That's a great question, and it's interesting because I feel like this is a question that has kind of evolved over time. For many decades, the typical television episode, whether it was a serialized television series or not, was relatively standalone. Mm. And you could just come in, watch that one episode, and then back out.
I hate that we have to repeatedly explain this.
But like, it's
because
true.
It wasn't so long ago that TV did this.
Yeah.
It wasn't until like maybe the mid-2000s that TV started making a shift in larger arcs in earnest.
There were definitely some progenitors of that, but in the 2000s it became very, very popular like Lost or 24 or The Sopranos or various other prestige programming. And as a result, focusing on an individual episode as a unique highlight is less common now, unless that episode really, really stands out. There's a really great episode of Breaking Bad, which kind of takes a break from the entire, serialized narrative. Mm-hmm. And it's entirely about Walter, and I think Jesse is his name. And, you know, they're making meth.
Is that the Aaron Paul character?
Aaron Paul, yeah. Who's the actor? Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul. Just for the sake, if you don't know the names, the characters. Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul, they're making meth. That's what their characters are doing. And there's one episode where they become obsessed with finding a fly in their meth lab and killing it so it won't contaminate everything that they've done. So it's a big fly hunt, and it was directed by Rian Johnson. And that's a really good standalone episode of that because it kind of lifts out of the rest of the show.
Yeah.
And you can kind of just watch that episode. So that's a good one. Mm-hmm. That's a recent one. It's a relatively well-known one. I'm trying to think of a few others that are less common.
One that this one's mentioned a lot by like TV historians, but when I was a kid, I would watch reruns of I Love Lucy all the time on TV.
Oh, yeah.
And I liked I Love Lucy even as a little kid, but it wasn't until I got together with like a big group of friends and we started sort of looking at it as an art. that we got to really appreciate just how sublimely timed out I Love Lucy is, yeah. and what great comedians just all of the actors are.
Yeah.
It's not just Lucille Ball. It's not just Desi. It's also William Frawley and Vivian Vance.
That's a great ensemble. They were brilliant comedians.
All four of them. And the famous episode where they get a job in the chocolate factory and the chocolates come too fast and they have to start putting them in their mouth. It's a cliche now. It is brilliant. Like, you're not laughing because you're surprised at what happens. Mm-hmm. You're laughing at how perfectly it happens.
It's actually stunning when you watch old episodes of I Love Lucy, just how many episodes... I mean, it took them a little bit to find their footing, but just how many episodes are comic genius. There's a really, really good one I recommend called Lucy Does a TV Commercial.
Is this the Vitamita Vegemin?
Vitamita Vegemin, where basically she's offered a gig on a television to promote a new health drink.
It's like a serum.
And the whole thing is she's supposed to take a drink of it and give a little spiel.
A spoonful. She has to take a spoonful. She takes
a spoonful of this thing and she gives a little spiel. And she does the spiel perfectly, but she has to do so many takes, and it turns out that there's a lot of alcohol in it. Mm. So by the time they're actually doing it live, the entire bit has warped and become an entirely different monologue, and it's a brilliant piece of comic writing. Mm. So that's a really good example here. However, I do warn you, a lot of Lucy episodes haven't aged as well as you might want them to, and there's some racism and sexism in there.
In the 1950s, so it's being written by white writers in the 1950s.
But a surprising number of them actually do work still to this day, just because they're kind of just existing to set up one big gag, and then the big gag goes off beautifully, and that's the whole thing.
I don't know if it's being broadcast anywhere, if it's on usually streaming services.
I think it still is. There's, like, Lucy is, like, always broadcast somewhere. It's, like, the most syndicated show in, like, TV history. What else? What are some other good... Twilight Zone had a million great episodes. I'm trying to think of, like, we have, like, one. Night of the Meek is a great Christmas episode.
It's
really, really bittersweet and beautiful. I like that one a lot.
There is my favorite... One of my favorite episodes of Tales from the Crypt, which is one of my favorite shows, wasn't initially intended to be an episode of Tales from the Crypt.
Yellow.
They were trying to do a spin-off series called Two-Fisted Tales, which was also based on old EC comics. And Two-Fisted Tales were all war stories, but they were also often twinged with some sort of, like, irony or poetic justice. Just took place in the trenches of certain wars, and there was a lot of war violence. So they decided to make a pilot for Two-Fisted Tales, and they made an episode called Yellow.
Mm-hmm.
With Kirk Douglas, and it was about a soldier who was going to be put to death for desertion.
Yeah, for cowardice, basically.
His
father was a high-ranking officer and is very ashamed of his son, and it's all about, like, how his father is going to deal with it. And it's a Tales from the Crypt episode, so something really shitty happens, but it's brilliant.
Yeah,
it's a brilliant bit of writing.
And it's a lot of discussion as to, is this cowardice or is this common sense? Is running away from people who are shooting at you cowardly, or is that saving your life?
It's really good.
And there's a lot of discussions to that. And so it doesn't have the same sort of, like, grim sense of fun that most of Tales from the Crypt has, but it's still really a brilliant piece of television.
It's actually genuinely poignant, that episode, I think. I'm a big fan of the television series Avatar: The Last Airbender. And that's a show that does a really good job of combining individual episodes with a larger story arc. And there are at least two episodes of Avatar: The Last Airbender that I consider basically perfect. And they're both in the second season. They're actually really close to each other. One of them is called The Tales of Ba Sing Se. And it's after Aang and all of his fellow travelers have come to this gigantic walled-off city, and they discover that it's actually not as utopian as they thought it was. But Tales of Ba Sing Se is all of the characters get, like, their own story. It's kind of the, 22 short films about Springfield kind of thing. Except this one is funny, but it's also...
Canterbury Tales.
Canterbury Tales as well. It's a format. It's an anthology format within the episode. And it's genuinely funny until it is genuinely heartbreaking. And then two episodes after that, there's an episode called Appa's... I'm sorry, one episode after that. My apologies. Just the right in a row. Appa's Lost Days. Earlier in the season, Aang had lost his pet, his mount. He has a flying bison.
Oh, yeah, and it's got like eight legs or something.
Yeah, and it's his best friend, it's family to him, and he lost it in a tragic circumstance, and no one knew where it went. Mm. And in that episode, you find out what happened to Appa, and it's the saddest fucking thing in the world. It's genuinely beautiful, potent, harrowing drama.
He couldn't hold the door.
Yeah. Oh, please. Game of Thrones wishes it could pull off an episode like Appa's Lost Days. I'm dead serious. Those are good. There's a lot of really brilliant... My favorite episodes of The X-Files are the funny ones. War of the Corprophage is a great one. Humbug is a great one. Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose is funny and sad.
Yeah,
that may be the best episode of the whole series.
I would argue Bad Blood, because that's sort of a Rashomon episode as well.
It's a fun one. It's a fun one.
It's really, really funny.
Jose Chung's From Outer Space is brilliant on any given day.
Jose Chung's From Outer Space with... Because they cast Charles Nelson Reilly for first thing.
Ugh.
And there's also a really brilliant cameo from Alex Trebek.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen the episode, I'm going to hold it off because you really need to experience that episode.
Yeah.
What are some of my favorite? It's hard to pick out like the best of all the Star Treks. But we talk about Star Trek
favorites.
All the
time, we have our favorites.
We have our favorites.
Yeah. I'm a big fan. I'll go to bat for this and I don't get a chance to talk about it as much. Hmm. Outside of our Star Trek podcast on Patreon, but the animated series episode Yesteryear is one of the great Spock stories, and people don't talk about it enough.
Yeah, where Spock goes back in time and meets himself as a child.
Yeah, that's actually like a really great story, and I will take the Pepsi challenge with that and any classic live action episode.
Absolutely.
It's at least as good as almost any other classic Star Trek.
The animated series was, on the whole, just better written than the original series, especially when you compare it to some of those early season one episodes where it's like...
They don't know what the hell the show is yet.
Here's a child planet that's somehow just like Earth. Also, there's time travel. It's like, what's this episode about? What is going on here?
Yeah. It's kind of exists in its own nebulous universe, but we all have our favorite episodes of Mystery Science Theater 3000.
For me,
I think Cave Dwellers is wall-to-wall the funniest one, but not a year will go by that I don't watch Santa Claus Conquers the Martians on MST3K, at least at Christmas time.
No, the classics are classics for a reason. Mm. Cave Dwellers, Mitchell, Pod People, Ega, these are all
speaking of Christmas episodes.
Two-hour chunks of television.
Real fast, just I don't want to forget, there's a wonderful, wonderful episode of Justice League called Comfort and Joy, which is about what all the members of the Justice League do on Christmas. And it's really, 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 really sweet. And there's a whole bit where the Flash wants to, like, get a gift for all the kids at this orphanage. But damn it, like, what is it? The Ultra Humanite breaks it while he's in the middle of, like, stealing some stuff. And so he, like, guilts the Ultra Humanite into making the kids a better toy. That's a great bit.
I know there was a bit in, I think you showed me something in a Justice League Christmas special where...
Was Superman and Martian Manhunter?
No, Clark Kent has gone home for Christmas.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's picking up the gifts from underneath the tree and kind of looking at him for a second.
Uh-huh.
And then just sort of muttering to himself, lead box. Like,
yeah, they use lead lined paper.
His parents have thought to wrap the presents in lead so he can't use his X-ray vision.
And I like that it's like the one kind of naughty thing Superman would do is try to sneak a peek at his presents. It's so fucking cute.
Shame on you.
There's the great bit in that one where... Because he takes Martian Manhunter home for Christmas because he has nowhere to go. He's the only Martian in existence. Mm-hmm. He has, you know, no home for Christmas. He doesn't want to take you home for...
Aren't other Martians?
Not in that show at that time, no. He was like the last of his kind. Much like Superman is the last Kryptonian.
Okay.
And so he wanted to take Martian Manhunter home for Christmas to, like, give him, like, a family for Christmas. And, you know, his family is, like, very welcoming. And
but he's, like a green alien man.
Yeah, but, like, they're cool with it. They know their son's an alien, so it's all good. But there's this great bit where they're talking about, oh god, yeah, it was so hard raising this one at Christmas time, you know, it's gotta find lead, you gotta wrap all your gifts in lead lined wrapping paper, and then Clark Kent, not missing a beat, says, you mean, Santa wrapped them. And his parents are like, yeah, sure Clark.
Sure Clark. Yeah, yes dear.
So that one gives me endless joy to watch that episode every single year. I watch that one
The thing with, like, comic episodes of The X-Files or, you know, the Christmas episode of Justice League.
Yeah.
Or even that episode of Breaking Bad you were talking about is they stand out because they're different from the rest of the show.
Yeah, they're a break from the routine, you know?
The big event episodes that sort of define what the show is, I'm not sure if those are ever the ones that people remember the best.
You know, sometimes shows earn them, and they do a good job, and this and they build up. I think Avatar builds up really, really well, and like those episodes actually really stand out. But yeah, oftentimes it's the ones that give us an opportunity to just sort of hang out with the characters.
Yeah.
And those are the ones that we really cherish, I find. So those are some of our examples. I'd be curious to hear if anyone else has a particularly interesting favorite television episode. You want to write in and talk to us about it?
Yeah, any show.
I'd be very, very curious to hear. But thank you for writing in.
Here's a letter from Brian. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
This is 2 cents from a Sopranos fan. I recently reviewed the film The Many Saints of Newark.
And we were in a unique position where I had not seen it, so I didn't review the film. But you had never seen The Sopranos, and while I wouldn't say that invalidates your opinion, you're not the target demographic for that movie, and so you probably came at it from a different angle.
Now that I've seen it, I know I'm not, but going in, there's no way to tell.
I think it's fair to say that the makers of that film were expecting people to have
a lot of familiarity with The
Sopranos. So you had an interesting take on it, and let's hear someone else's.
Brian says, well, Rockmeister, I couldn't agree more with your review.
Wow.
And I watched and loved the show. I really didn't even mind the controversial final episode. I was baffled, but not angry. Speaking of baffling, what is even more baffling is why the creative forces behind The Many Saints of Newark thought that they had a complete script, much less a compelling one. It's all threads and no tapestry. Each individual thread is interesting, but none of them are developed and none of them goes to a payoff. The most truly baffling thing in this movie was advertised with the slogan, "Who made Tony Soprano?" Well, nobody apparently, because Tony and Dickie have so few scenes together that there's no sense that Dickie, this is the Alessandro Nivola character, was a crucial influence in his life. And the scenes they did have together have no resonance. Nothing in this movie has any resonance. A creator/writer David Chase made a great TV show. He is way too talented to write this script and see this movie and think he nailed it. How could they not see how undercooked it was? So, yep, a C- from this Sopranos watcher, albeit a high one because at least those individual threads are interesting.
Oh, there you go.
Yours, Brian.
You know, it always fascinates me how, you know, a lot of people will like, you know, the show is successful and people want to see it continue. And every once in a while it can continue successfully after a break or whatever. But sometimes it just doesn't. You know, all the X-Files movies were disappointing to me in some way. Like, X-Files the movie was not a particularly interesting conspiracy episode. Like, the scale was bigger and that was nice. But if it was an episode of the show, it wouldn't go down as one of the best. And then,
I suppose it was notable in that it showed things in the movie that I think they either didn't have the budget or just the temerity to do in the show. Like, they actually had a flying saucer on camera.
Right, and that's cool.
Uncommon on the show.
That's cool, but that's budgetary. That's not really story-wise. Yeah, so, like, it's cool to see that, but is the story really something that would be that interesting? And then I Want to Believe is just a bad movie.
I Want to Believe, they didn't think that one. Well, it was...
very little of that movie is even memorable to me. Like, I remember Billy Connolly trying really hard.
The ethical dilemma is they found a genuine psychic who can locate like the dead bodies or the source of like the scenes of crimes, and the FBI is using him to help, but he's also a convicted child molester, so they don't know how much they want to employ. So how ethical is it to let him stay free if he's helping the FBI?
Which really seems more, that's a fucked up storyline, and B, that feels more like an episode than a movie, doesn't it?
It sure does.
Yeah.
And also it came out during the George W. Bush administration, whereas The X-Files is very much a Clinton administration kind of show.
Well, you got to see how The X-Files really struggled to find any reason to exist when they actually brought the series back.
Yeah.
Every time they tried to talk about something topical. Look, the fucking government and basically admitted UFOs exist publicly to everyone. And you know what happened? Not a goddamn thing.
Yeah,
that kind of invalidates the entire premise of The X-Files.
That if everybody found out, it would just cause chaos and disorder.
It's like, no, it's not worth keeping the secrets. Yeah. It's not worth it. We would go, oh, well, we kind of suspected that.
We want transparency. Thank you for that. Now more, please.
Yeah, our universe.
Give us transparency on the money and the power structure, and we'd be happier. Thank you for shedding a little light from like an actual Sopranos fan, because I have not seen the show. And after seeing the movie, I'm not really moved to see the show. There's nothing about those characters or that kind of storytelling that I found particularly compelling.
Well, that's not encouraging, is it?
No.
All right, moving on.
Here's a letter from Humphrey Moose.
Oh, hi, Humphrey Moose. Been well.
Hello, Bibbs and Mount Whitney. Bit of trivia, I was named after Mount Whitney.
Indeed.
Yeah, my mom said that if they had a boy, they would name it after Mount Whitney. Mm-hmm. And if they had a girl, they would name it after Mount Shasta. So if...
Oh, you'd have been a great Shasta.
If I had been born in a female body, I would have been named Shasta.
Is Mount Whitney the highest peak in America or just like on this like coast?
It's the highest peak in California.
Okay. I was a little hazy on that. Okay.
McKinley is the highest peak in the United States.
Okay, thank you. I'm not crazy. All right, that makes sense. All right. All right, moving on.
I want to start off by saying you two are aces, the best. Oh,
very kind.
We're okay.
take the compliment, Whitney. You're great.
Had a blast from the past as I finally got around to seeing Promising Young Woman.
Oh.
And holy God, I stopped halfway through to get a snack and I found I was shaking from adrenaline and anger. I went back and listened to your review and I loved/agreed with it wholeheartedly. I barely recognized the cue for Britney Spears' Toxic as the arrangement came up, only noticing because of my subtitles. And I was pleased to remember Whitney found that as exciting as I did when he listened.
They very cleverly use a cover of Toxic, which is a great fucking cover of Toxic.
Yeah, there's the great cover of Toxic, and they also... rather cleverly use a music cue from Paris Hilton.
Oh, yeah, that's really great.
Yeah, which is the best use of a Paris Hilton song in a movie.
Also, I must admit, I think, slight subject change, but Malignant has the best use of Where Is My Mind since Fight Club. really great use of that. Anyway, moving on.
Two things crossed my mind about your review. One, I wish you had spent a little more time discussing how her particular choices and method of dealing with her grief, her, quote, bar hopping, had kept her, the state of a raid development and how forgiveness is seen in the context of the film. Arrested. Okay, it says a raid.
That's okay.
Sorry, I was a little thrown. Both of those I thought were really critical things of how her agency is adjusted, her sense of justice, and and how the forms of forgiveness and mercy have in the film. Even without spoiling plot pieces, I was wanting more after seeing the film. And number two, and I understand why this is, but in the same podcast, you spent 32 minutes discussing Wonder Woman 1984, another 20 minutes discussing Soul, and a scant 9 minutes talking about this movie. I understand why, but why?
That's actually a good question.
Letting you know that your shows are appreciated, and now I have to go and have a good cry because I hope I never have to do anything like that for my loved ones. Thank you for being the good cats you are, even Whitney's terrible ability to remember plot details.
Yeah.
Your Shang-Chi recap was particularly vexing. Warmest regards, Humphrey Moo. What did I get wrong about Shang-Chi?
I don't know. I haven't seen it yet. Okay. When I see it, okay. I'm going to re-listen to your review, and I'm going to... Maybe this so. Is the second or third time I've heard this. I need to go back. Whitney is the type of critic, and I really think this is fine, but I do think it's something that people should be aware of. And tell me if I'm wrong here. You consider plot a detail.
Pretty much. Plot is less important, I think, than it typically gets credit for. I've used this metaphor before, and it's clumsy as hell, but I feel like a plot or a story is like the clothesline on which you hang a quilt.
Yeah.
You're here to see the quilt.
Right.
The clothesline needs to be tight. It needs to be really functional.
It needs to keep the quilt up. And if it doesn't do that, then the plot's a problem.
But all you need is for it to be like a structure, something to hang something on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're looking at, is what's hanging up.
I don't entirely agree with you here, but I do respect this opinion.
What you're looking at is character moments and emotions and themes and tones and philosophies, the things that are actually being communicated to you through the story. The story is a functional part of a movie. So I tend not to... focus on it too much.
I tend to believe that's more on a case-by-case basis. I believe that certain films are more about conveying plot than others. And in those cases, if the plot doesn't work, it becomes more of a problem.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, I see your point.
In those Marvel movies, the plots tend to be like a little bit convoluted. Like even
sometimes,
though...
Sometimes.
There's an ancient gangster with magic rings. He needs two dragon eyes, and when he inserts the dragon eyes into a statue, it reveals a map to a moving maze, which will lead to a magical village. And in the magical village is a magical door to the afterworld, where his dead wife is living. And he wants to break it open, but if he does so, demons will get out.
Wait a minute.
That's the plot of the movie.
That's in a roundabout way. That's the plot to Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Kingpin builds all of these machines to get him doorway into like a world where his wife is still alive, and in the process, okay, weird. Anyway,
And there are other details, like Shang-Chi has one of the necklaces. He sends bad guys out to get it.
Here's the thing. Moving away from that, because that's ultra-specific. And I think this also ties into why maybe we spent a little less time talking about Promising a Woman. We talked about it way more at the end of the year when we did our best films of the year. So we did give it more time. But certain movies, because they are of a particular genre, or they have certain expectations that they are gleeful to meet. It doesn't matter how much you talk about the plot.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to go nuts and, like, reveal every single thing, but you can kind of be cavalier about it, and you can talk about, like, oh, here's how the people in this rom-com would end up together. What, you didn't think they would? Mm-hmm. Like, so we can, like, be a little bit more elaborate and a little bit more detailed when we're reviewing a movie that has only just come out and not everyone has seen it. Mm-hmm. In the case of something like Promising Young Woman, a movie which is, by the way, and I know some people were not a fan, and I've read some negative criticism of the film, which is entirely valid. It's a complicated movie with some complicated viewpoints, and I totally get why some people just did not appreciate it. I come at it from a different angle, but I totally get it. I think it's one of the things that makes it interesting. But because the movie is such a surprise, because so much of the movie is uniquely structured, and it's a story that is told in a very unusual way, the more we could articulate about it, the less impact it would have. And we try to focus on this, I think, on a case-by-case basis in terms of which movies... We would love to spend an hour talking about every single movie. Wouldn't that be great? But we do have to pick our battles sometimes. And in the case of movies that, you know, maybe are a little less well-advertised, people haven't watched the trailers, which give away too much over and over again, I feel like we try when we can, especially when we like them, to err on the side of not giving away too much.
Yeah.
So as a result, sometimes this results in newer films that we love being spoken of a little bit more briefly, a little bit more vaguely. That's a downside. And, you know, hey, maybe we're wrong to do that. Maybe we should be doing it the exact opposite way. I don't know.
Well, when it comes to something like WW84,
that
is a movie, that is a bad movie, by the way. Just flat out bad film. And
it's a shame. There's a few things I like about it, but mostly it does not work.
It doesn't work. The story is dumb. The central conceit itself is a little strange.
Yeah, it's weirdly like hypocritical in its portrayal of its villains. Yeah, the way it treats cheetahs it pisses me off to this day.
Yeah.
They really, really fucking hypocritical.
So when we're talking about a movie like that, it fails in so many respects.
Yeah.
Like with story and character bits that these things are sort of in our head that actually takes us a while to unpack all of that.
Yeah.
It's not that it warrants that much time, that it's a more important film in any kind of way.
And it's important could argue that maybe it is because it's going to reach more people, and as a result, it warrants a significant amount of analysis, because otherwise people might just absorb it without thinking. I think that's a concern I often have about the more mainstream entertainment, is that they get less critical analysis when they should get more, because
more people are getting certain lessons. They
potentially could have a greater impact on a larger group of people. But your point is entirely valid, and I think it boils down to something that a lot of critics talk about. I know I have. It's easier to write or give, in our case in a podcast, a review of a movie that doesn't work because it's easy to dictate the content. Here's why it does not work.
Yeah, we figured out why it doesn't work.
And if there's a lot wrong with it, you have plenty of material. If it's good, we can explain what works, but it's trickier to explain what works if someone hasn't seen it. And the other thing is that if it does work, I think we're a little bit more eager to let people discover it for themselves as much as we can. And not try to go into too much detail ahead of time, so that hopefully we can recommend a movie while still allowing you, the audience, our audience, to, if you haven't seen the movie yet, see it the way we saw it to some extent, which is with somewhat fresh eyes.
Yeah.
Because it's a danger when a critic either oversells or undersells something. You know, like if we undersell something, you might not go see it. If we oversell it, there's a chance that you will go see it, but maybe you'll have thought it would be the greatest thing in the universe and instead it was merely really good, and all of a sudden a movie that you would have thought was really good becomes some kind of disappointment.
It's a
slippery slope.
Our brief review is in its own weird way a stronger selling point.
That's the idea anyway, and maybe it's misguided. I don't know, but that's where our head's at.
And again, if we delve too much into a movie like Promising Young Woman, we give it away.
Yeah. And that's actually one where the plot and the events are interesting enough them away would really hurt the film.
Dave White gave me gave me a pretty good philosophy when it comes to like spoilers and revealing too much information about a movie.
Uh-huh.
It's like don't like give away any kind of like significant surprises. And if you're a wise critic, you know what to discern what those things are. Unless it's the selling point.
Yeah.
If you can't sell it in any other way, saying this movie was really boring, but then it pulled this really weird twist out of nowhere, I'm going to tell you about that twist.
Because otherwise, no one's going to bother to see it and find out there was a twist there.
Yeah. If it's like something like the movie Serenity.
I was going to bring this up.
Which is...
Not the Joss Whedon film, the Matthew McConaughey film.
The Matthew McConaughey film, it's sort of like this scuzzy beach noir about a wife of the Matthew McConaughey character who hires him to kill her new husband.
Yeah.
And
there's a twist in that movie.
There's a twist in the middle.
That is so completely what the fuck.
It's like
that you kind of just have to see it to believe it. But here's the thing, if we didn't tell you that twist was there, all you would hear is scuzzy beach movie with Matthew McConaughey. And we would have to tell you that scuzzy beach movie without the twist isn't very interesting. Because it's not. The twist doesn't make the movie good. The movie is stupid. But it sure is interesting.
It does something different. It's a really special kind of stupid. Yeah. I recommend you watch Serenity because it's quite bad.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on to another.
These are issues that critics wrestle with a lot. How much time do we give something? How much do we give away? We make choices. Sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're bad. But we're trying to do the right thing to the best of our abilities.
Trying to hone our instincts constantly. Here's a letter from The Windy. Hello, The Windy.
Hello,
Dear Bibbs and the coolest master of all rock.
See, you got the cool nickname.
Sucker MC is better call me sire.
Damn it. All right. Anyway,
in one of her recent critically acclaimed episodes, William talked about going to his local library and looking for information on fighting demons and vampires or other movie baddies.
Yeah.
You commented on this because this is a common trope in monster movies.
Often in a monster movie, people will be like, oh no, we're being hunted by a demon or something, and they'll go to their local library and go to the apparently extensive demonology section, and they'll find some ancient tome that's full of great detail. And as an experiment, I went to my closest local library, and it was just like, what if I was being attacked by a demon? What could I find at my local library? And the best I could find was a book that says, if a demon is after you, get a talisman. That's it. There was no additional information. Just some kind of talisman.
Well, I took it upon myself. This is the listener. Aww. I took it upon myself to try this. Granted, I did not go to my local library, but rather one of the biggest public libraries in Vienna. I put on some montage music, and I got started. I actually found more than I thought I would, as I expected. Yeah. Not really books written by people who believe in various subjects to tell you what to do, rather by people who do research about the topics. A lot of books about the history of the belief in vampires, werewolves, and ghosts, and how these myths started in various cultures. Mm. So I'd say, if really something really happens to you, you would definitely find a lot of material in this library, but most of it probably would not be helpful in dealing with a demon or whatever else ails you. You would probably have to sift through a lot of pages of descriptive research to probably get conflicting advice about how to deal with your supernatural adversary.
I would love for this to be the official Yelp review of that library. Like, if you're... It's perfectly good.
The biggest library in Vienna.
If you're looking for cookbooks, awesome. If you're looking for a book on demonology, you're going to be doing some sifting if you want practical applications.
Here's what I found. You go into, like... The main body of the library, you're going to find like well-researched books about folklore and myths.
Yeah.
And those will be interesting, those will be helpful, and those will be, you know,
very scholarly,
good information and scholarly and well-researched, but yeah, they're not going to tell you how to shoot a demon in the head.
They're not going to just flat out say, listen, there's not going to be a chapter say, so you've got a Bagul problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And here's how to stop them. Like...
You know where you go? You go to the kids section of the library.
That's true.
That has more practical, actionable advice.
That's actually true.
There's go to a really thin book with a lot of pictures.
Yeah. The main branch of... I grew up in Pasadena, California. The main branch of the Pasadena Library. By the way, beautiful library.
Mm.
Just absolutely stunning. Looks like the movie Seven. Like, just really classical old library. Mm. I haven't been inside in a while. I hope they haven't renovated because it's gorgeous. They had a pretty big kids section. It was all, like... this whole corner of the library and had this gorgeous green carpet and like, and they had like ton of occult shit in there.
Uh-huh.
And it was all like, here, you can tell if a person's a werewolf if they have like hairy palms whatever.
Yeah,
like,
hairy palms. If the three first fingers on their hands are the same length.
Yeah, that's
something I learned from the kids section.
I kept checking out all these books. Yeah, the adult section is always just like, it's probably not true. The kids section is like, it is true, and you should have a wooden stake under your bed at all fucking times.
Just in case.
And I'm like, who the hell? What a choice that publisher made. Holy shit.
So yeah, next time you do research about monsters, go straight to the kids section.
Nicely done.
They'll let you know. There's more of this letter.
Please.
On an unrelated note, but relating to a recent letter from Brazil, I think, there are a lot of movies that have vastly different titles in the German-speaking region.
Oh yeah, we were talking certain movies, when they're released internationally, they get retitled for reasons which sometimes may seem arbitrary, but usually it's something to do with the original title doesn't translate very well into every language, or the market in a different country or culture might respond well to a different approach to titling. So in Germany, what do we got?
Tremors was called In the Land of the Rocket Worms.
Awesome.
And awesome. And they're translating the German title for
it. That's awesome.
The Pacifier. The Pacifier, which is the Vin Diesel film, became The Baby Nader.
Ooh.
Life of Pi became Shipwreck with Tiger. Which sounds like a painting title to me.
It is what it is. Mm-hmm. It's on the tin.
This is good. In Bruges became To See Bruges, Ellipsis, and Die? With a question mark.
Nice.
Yes, there's a question mark in the German title.
I love it.
To See Bruges and Die. Monty Python and the Holy Grail became The Knights of the Coconut.
That's cute. That's good. That works, I bet. Yeah.
The original Ocean's 11, Frankie and his Shooting Buddies.
I love that. I want to see a book called that. That sounds like a book about the making of Ocean's 11.
And The Men Who Knew Too Little became Agent 00 Nothing.
Yeah, no tracks. Yeah, it's a James Bond knockoff bit. Yeah, it's cute.
Escape from New York was called The Rattlesnake.
Snake is a snake. Buy it. Yeah, it works.
And if it's not confusing enough, this is a new trend to still give movies an English title, but a different one from the original. Like, in Germany, Thor the Dark World was, in English, called Thor the Dark Kingdom.
Oh.
And Captain America the Winter Soldier was The Return of the First Avenger.
Well,
I actually like that better.
That's a good name, yeah. It's got some poetry. I always like, sort of more verbose titles than they have poetry to them.
And the movie Cold Pursuit, that's the Liam Neeson film, if you remember that one, became Hard Powder.
Ooh.
Because it takes place in the snow.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
And many more. One last thing, I promise, and then I'm done. You recently talked about representation of disabled people in movies, and that disabilities are hardly ever coincidental to the plot. In Jennifer's Body, J.K. Simmons' character has a hook for a hand, and it's just a thing.
Yeah.
Neither the movie nor the character ever points this out. It has nothing to do with anything. No hint of why he lost a hand. He's just a normal high school teacher who has normal high school teacher character things. It's still an able actor playing the role, but I wanted to bring it up because you talked about
it. That is a good example and thing. I had forgotten about that.
Thank you for your time and all the shows you produced. Yours, The Windy.
Thank you for that. Yeah. It always weirds me out when, like, it's almost weirder when different countries don't translate the title. Mm. I remember finding out about this from Eddie Izzard, who in his Dressed to Kill special talked about how he did a recap of the movie Speed, but in French, which was kind of funny. And of course, yes, that was from the movie Speed, which in France, of course, was called La Vitesse, or at least it should have been. Instead, it was called Speed.
they didn't translate it into French.
Sometimes. Et tu maman tambien, they didn't translate that, you know?
I remember, often here in the United States, they'll give us both.
Mm-hmm. Almost like a subtitle.
It's like The Postman in parentheses, Il Postino.
There you go.
You can just call it Il Postino. I mean,
yeah,
we can pronounce that.
Yeah. Life is Beautiful, La Vita e Bella.
Yeah.
That happens as well. Yeah.
They'd like to do that sort of double up. Often they'll just sort of give us the original title. Titan is a good example. That's the French word for titanium. They didn't call it titanium here in the United States. They called it Titan, and that's how we've been referring to it.
It is what it is. But anyway, thank you so much, and we're always curious to hear more of these. I forgot one of them. I think it's Japan. Fast and Furious isn't called the Fast and Furious; it's called Wild Speed.
That's right.
Which is an awesome name, And then when they did the spin-off of Hobbs and Shaw, it was called Wild Speed, Super Combo. Awesome.
Wild Speed Super Combo is a better title than any of those.
Yeah.
I mean, the first one has a really ungainly title anyway.
The Fast and the Furious.
Fast and the Furious. And they waited until the fourth movie just to use the phrase Fast and Furious.
Yep.
Which is the parlance we use.
Yeah, a little cleaner, yeah.
The Fast and the Furious implies that there's two classes of people in that movie.
Yeah.
Some of them are fast and some of them are furious.
Indeed.
But it's
Vin Diesel is furious. Paul Walker is merely fast.
Well, Vin Diesel is the leader of a car driving gang. You think he's the fast one.
Yeah, but he's the angriest, he's still the furious.
And the law enforcement is, like, angry that he's getting away with crime, so they'd be furious, right?
Yeah, I don't know if that's not fury. That's not fury, though. They're not, like, it's not personal to them. Whereas Vin Diesel has got a lot of anger he's working out.
Remember when they were just, like, stealing stuff from trucks?
They were stealing DVD players. That's how old the original Fast and Furious is now. They're stealing DVD players.
Given how big their internal structure is and how many of them have, like, their own garages and stuff, I'm guessing that was a pretty lucrative business.
Apparently. It amazes me. I remember watching that movie and I was totally amazed. Like, wait a minute. You show up with, like, a supercharged, top-of-the-line engine, ultra race car. And then you just cavalierly bet the car, and then you just give it away, and you just get another car? Where the fuck do you work? Where the fuck do you work that you're getting this shit?
They live in a world where cars are the currency. They don't use money to pay for the cars.
But how do you get a car?
They trade cars around. Well,
how do you get a car?
You prove yourself in test of courage.
In Carmbat. Anyway, moving on.
You go into Detroit and
Whitney,
live in
I beg
world.
Of you, let's move
All right, fine.
We got time for one or two more.
Here's a letter from JP. Hello, JP.
Hi, JP.
Dear Bibbs and Rockmeister, following up on your discussion of No Time to Die and Muppet's Haunted Mansion.
Oh, I love that these are together.
I here present my treatment of The Man with the Golden Hen.
Thank you for this.
James Bond Muppet mashup. Unlike you, I decided on an all Muppet cast. James Pond would be played by Kermit.
I feel like that has to have been done.
James
Doesn't
Pond.
That feel like that has to have been
I
like
did
a gag?
Spoof like that on the Muppet
Come
show.
Come on, how could they not? That's brilliant. If you came, I'm not accusing him of anything, but if you came up with that all on your own, that's fucking brilliant, and I'm disappointed in the makers of the Muppet show for not doing it sooner. Because James Pond is good. But moving on.
M is played by Dr. Teeth.
Mm.
Moneypenny is Janice.
Yeah.
Dr. Bunsen Honey Q.
Yeah, that works.
Is Q.
You gotta do that,
and
yeah.
Beaker is R.
Yeah.
The CIA station chief is Sam the Eagle. Felix Fozzie Leiter is Fozzie Bear. Fozzie plays Felix Leiter. Dr. Gonzo is the villain. Gonzo.
I get it.
Paws is Animal, and Piggy Galore is Miss Piggy.
Yeah. All these things work.
The plot. M sends Pond to investigate the mysterious phenomena of people being turned into chickens. Possibly including another 00 agent who we only see as a chicken. M is suspicious of a man who has recently become a powerful player in the chicken market, Dr. Zoe. After a brief flirtation with Moneypenny and a check-in with Dr. Bunsen Honey-Q to get an anti-chicken watch, it sprays chicken wire, Pond goes to meet the mysterious Dr. Zoe. Dr. Zoe is... surprisingly friendly, and his assistant, Piggy Galore, there's probably some flirting here too, though mostly on the part of Piggy, show him around the base, but when he tries to look into the restricted area, say, what's over there? He's discouraged by the fearsome paws. That's like Jaws.
No, I get it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I've cracked your code.
Yes, is it?
You're insidious.
That night, Pond is sneaking around when he discovers Dr. Zoe and his rocket and his evil laboratory where you see, dun-dun-dun, a Muppet being transformed into a chicken. He also finds Dr. Zoe has his own rocket. Unfortunately, he is discovered by Paws and all his men, well, Muppets, who capture him. He is strapped to a table and we get the villain monologue from Dr. Zoe about how he plans to launch his chicken ray into space and turn the entire planet into chickens. But why? I like chickens.
Oh, yeah, that sounds right.
He activates the ray so Pond will be transformed, but leaves it before it activates because he's a Bond villain, only for Pond to be rescued by Piggy Galore. Bond escapes and seeks the help from the CIA. The station chief is dubious but assigns an agent, Fozzie Leiter, to help. The final act is Paws and Felix assaulting Dr. Zoe's lair before he can launch his rocket. Obviously, the forces of good win, helped by the defection of Piggy Galore. And the movie ends with Dr. Zoe being blasted by his own rocket, but without the transforming ray, while Pond and Piggy smooch. And the rest, and the rocket rises, we see the Electric Mayhem playing the Bond theme.
Okay, I have one question. Who's Paws? Like, who's playing? Because I assumed Fozzie was Paws.
Sorry, Paws was Animal.
Oh, Paws is Animal. Yeah. Okay, then that's fine. Yeah, okay, yeah. That works.
I realized...
Because for a second I assumed it was Fozzie, and then Fozzie came in later. Okay.
I realize Dr. Teeth is an unusual choice for M, but there aren't very many female Muppets, so Janet as Moneypenny was my only choice. I picture her as being way more into Pond than he is into her. I wait for Disney and or Eon Productions to contact me to write the complete script, JP.
We just need more Muppets everywhere. That's the solution to life, the universe, and everything, really. A liberal application of Muppets never hurt anything.
Really surprised they haven't tried to oversaturate with Muppets. I mean, that's Disney's shtick. If they find something that works, they exploit and they exploit. All they have is milking stools that they sit on and they put it next to whatever property they have and they just milk until the animal dies.
Disney was really gung-ho about the Muppets. Well, first off, Disney has had like this on-and-off relationship with the Muppets. Well, like, they had them for a while in the 90s and then they didn't
Disney
again.
Disney bought the Muppets in the 80s, but they only bought like the distribution rights. So I think
they had limited rights to the Muppets.
I think the Muppet movies made in the 90s were distributed by Disney, but made by a different production company.
I don't know.
I'd have to look up the actual details of this.
The point is, Disney finally like outright acquired the Muppets around, I think, shortly before they did The Muppets with Jason Segel.
That movie,
And the Muppets was a big hit, won an Academy Award, and then you know what? It's a really good movie. They made a sequel, Muppets Most Wanted. It's okay. I rewatched it not that long ago. It's mostly funny. It's shabbier than the last one. Mm-hmm. And then they were really gung-ho about that Muppets sitcom, which was like a takeoff of The Office.
Yeah, which failed miserably.
Which is a shame because it actually found itself halfway through its first season. But by that point, everyone had already jumped ship. The second half of that Muppets Office show is genuinely good Muppets.
Mm-hmm.
It's a genuinely good Muppet show. And now I just think they got a little gun shy. You know, they're not really ready to commit. And, that's stupid. And I'm going to say this right now. I've said this before. I will keep saying it until I will this into existence. Here's what Disney needs to do. Disney owns ABC. ABC, the network, is home of the Oscars. The Muppets should host the Oscars.
Everyone would tune in.
Doesn't matter if they don't care about the movies. They would always say that, like, oh, well, do the people even care about these movies this year? They care about Muppets. Let them do Muppet stuff. Promise that every single major celebrity who comes on stage gets to do a bit with a Muppet. You will get the top flight clientele. You will get, like, Jack Nicholson will come back. Okay? Like, John Wayne will come back from the fucking dead. Okay? People will jump at this chance. Make it so, damn it. What the fuck? Anyway, moving on. But thank you for that. That's a fun pitch. Hmm. And then we again, more Muppets, please.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. One more letter? One last letter.
Here's a letter from Ryan. Hello, Ryan. Hey, guys. Hope you're chilling. On your recent Hitchcock episode, Bibbs called Rear Window a perfect movie. I've heard this take from people before. While I like Rear Window, I wanted to bring up something about the film that has always bugged me and has kept me from calling it perfect.
Okay.
I haven't heard this point made before, so it's possible I'm wrong, in which case, hopefully you can help me appreciate the movie better. Rear Window spoilers to follow.
Okay, movie's over 70 years old now. I think it's fine.
Yeah. Jimmy Stewart's character at the beginning is a vain, arrogant man.
Yeah.
A traveling photographer and man of action. Because of his injury, he is bedridden and starts spying on his neighbors. In the process, he starts making callous assumptions about the people around him based only on his limited voyeurism.
Yes.
The people in his life, particularly Grace Kelly, suffer from this narcissism. To me, every carefully laid domino seems to build to the same inevitable conclusion that Stewart is wrong. As a viewer, you want his character to stop spying, to look around at Grace Kelly and appreciate his life. You want him to learn his lesson, become less cocksure, etc., etc. This is the emotional arc. But because it's Hitchcock, we must have the murder too. Stewart can't be all wrong. Therefore, the obvious way to have your cake and eat it too is that there should indeed be a murder at the apartment complex, but Stewart should misapprehend the killer's identity. Watching the first time, this outcome seemed inevitable and perfect. Instead, he's just right. The killer he guesses right away is the correct killer. And this isn't a huge anticlimax. Isn't this a huge anticlimax and a thematic betrayal? What lesson does the arrogant, spying Jimmy Stewart learn other than how right and cool he is? Rear Window was the first Hitchcock I watched way back when, and having heard it was a twisty, suspenseful film, the non-twist at the end disappointed me. To me, this makes Rear Window unsatisfying and imperfect.
Mm.
What say you guys? Thanks for all the great podcasting, and keep it up. Sincerely, Ryan.
Okay, Ryan, thank you so much for writing in. It's really great to actually have like a real meaningful conversation about a movie this old. A lot of people don't get that opportunity, so thank you very much for that. And you bring up an interesting point. Rear Window wants to have its cake and eat it too. Yeah. Rear Window wants to tell a story about paranoia, about the dangers of voyeurism, while still at the same time telling a story in which the voyeurism ends up being, well, accurate's not the right way to phrase it, but Jimmy Stewart is right. And there's something to that. Hitchcock was in the business of making thrillers. That's what he did. He was making a thriller first and a thoughtful character commentary, arguably second, I would say simultaneously. But it needed to have thrills. In order for that to be the case, you need to one could argue that maybe he was wrong and he misinterpreted the murder and there was a different way the murder could have taken place. And that maybe that would have been effective. I would argue that every single person that James Stewart looks at in his Rear Window is in some way reflective of his own life. And I would argue that Lars Torvald is that too. And I think he is afraid that he's not capable of commitment and that he will end up destroying Grace Kelly. And I think that by having Lars Torvald embody that nightmare for him and having him be someone who James Stewart can overcome, James Stewart is able to defeat a part of him that was incapable of being a partner in a relationship. Whereas if it was just about how he was wrong to be a voyeur, that would be fair, but a little pat.
Yeah.
And I don't think he would grow in the same way. So for me, that's how it works. But I do see your point.
I don't know. I mean, Hitchcock was himself a voyeur.
And he was.
Very much used the camera the way a voyeur uses a camera. So it's entirely possible that he's doesn't see the voyeurism as being too bad a crime. That it's not something Jimmy Stewart needs to learn a lesson about. It's just something he does. And I think Hitchcock is presenting this as a common activity of humanity rather than a violation of privacy.
In a lot of Hitchcock movies, an obsession with something a little creepy is not necessarily considered a great vice. A lot of people in his movies are interested in the academic idea of murder. A lot of people are interested, they get excited about murder. But when it's actually in front of them, they have a different attitude about it because it's one thing to think about it and it's another thing to actually fucking do it or be confronted by someone who does kill on the reg. So I think Rear Window is both things. I think it enjoys the titillation of voyeurism because that's the whole premise of the movie. It's what brought you into the theater. But it's also a little judgy of it because it knows that it's not a healthy activity. And in the end, he does stop doing it, doesn't he?
I think, but Hitchcock is presenting the voyeurism as something the audience is supposed to be getting a lascivious thrill out of.
Yeah, we're supposed to relate to the voyeurism.
We're not supposed to be sort of shying away from it or judging it. Also, I don't take it from it sort of the way he's alienating Grace Kelly, although that's definitely a part of it. I think it's a kind of a Boy Who Cried Wolf story.
It's about a
fellow who's always looking for a sensational story, and he said he's seen something interesting so many times that it adds to the thrill when he actually does see something. And it's a pretty basic sort of fable-like setup, but I think it functions on that level.
I think the film very masterfully handles the idea of we see what James Stewart sees. It's an incomplete picture, but when we see it the way he sees it, in the context that he sees it, it seems pretty convincing. It looks bad, but every time he tries to tell anybody without actually showing them what he saw, doesn't sound as good. It's like the difference between telling someone the plot of a movie and showing them the movie.
Right.
You know, it's like you can get the gist of it, but you're not going to get the sensation of it. And you're not going to get the same takeaway. And I think on that level, it's about something that's a little bit more about storytelling than anything else. So, again, I see your point. And I feel like on some level, one could say that it's dangerous to... Well, dangerous is an exaggeration. It's not necessarily the best critical perspective to think about what a movie could have been.
Yeah.
However, if you're thinking about what a movie could have been, there's a decent chance that what it is isn't engaging to you. It sounds like you've figured out why. It's because you feel like it doesn't necessarily satisfyingly wrap up its story. I would argue its story is maybe a little different than the one that you're interpreting it as. But both interpretations are valid. And I think that's fair. And of course, when I call anything a perfect movie, I realize that that's like, there's an argumentative side in all of us that wants to go, hey, wait a minute, I found a flaw in that. And fair. I do that too. But to me, it's perfect. And there aren't a lot of movies that I would give that label. So when I say Rear Window is perfect, what I am saying is that this movie gets my highest possible recommendation.
Okay.
And I think the fact that we can have these complicated conversations about it actually speaks to the complexity of Rear Window rather than necessarily its failings. However, again, I see your point. If that's your takeaway, cool. I get it. I can't really argue with that. I can just share my own different take.
Yeah. The idea of like the perfect movie, a movie that has no flaws.
Yeah.
Why do we have to give some sort of rarefied appellation to a single film?
Well, if I'm impressed enough that when I watch a movie, I really can't think of anything. Like, because you can watch any movie and go like, oh, this movie's amazing, but okay, the visual effect wasn't very good. You know, like something.
There's going to be something you can pick apart if you're looking for it. So,
but I'm a critic. I'm always looking. So if I can't find something, I tend to be extra impressed.
Okay.
So there's a handful of movies out there where I'm like, I just can't think of a way to improve that. I can't think of anything that they do wrong, per se.
Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah, that's all I mean. I'm not trying to, like, elevate anything. I'm just talking about... To me, I see this movie and I'm like, I can think of no meaningful criticism of this. This is just... This movie just does what it needs to do. Like My Neighbor Totoro. I can't think of a meaningful criticism of that movie. It's just purely great.
Totoro clearly needed to eat those kids. A big flaw in that movie.
Of course, I apologize.
No, when people say this movie is perfect, that makes me cock an eyebrow a little bit, because clearly they are saying, that's another way of saying this film is above reproach, which is another way of saying this film is above criticism.
And that
of course, you know, gets me, asshole contrarian that I am, sort of in my devil's advocate chair, saying, wait a minute here. Right. Well, where is the flaw? Now I have to start going through it with a nitpicker and trying to find the nits on it, its fur.
No movie is above criticism. Mm. No movie is above criticism. Even Rear Window, we just had a perfectly valid criticism of it. But at the end of the day, I've never read a criticism of Rear Window that made me go, okay, yeah, you're right, it does suck. Like, I'm always still, like, at the end of the day, like, I see your point. I personally take away something else on this particular film. But, you know, there's something out there for everybody. And not everyone's going to get the same mileage out of every film. That's just the end-all be-all of it. Sometimes it's about personal experience. Sometimes it's about your value system, what you value artistically, philosophically, politically, whatever. No, there aren't a lot of people who are going to have like the same list of perfect films, if even such a list exists.
Yeah.
So again, when I say perfect, I feel free to take it as a challenge if you want. That's your prerogative. Knock yourself out. But what I really mean to say is that I see this movie and I can't think of anything meaningfully negative to say about it.
Okay.
And I can't say that about a lot of movies. Some of my favorite movies ever made, yeah, they got plenty of flaws. Mm. They got plenty of things that don't work. Plot points that don't work. Visual effects that don't work. Performances that are not the best. Mm. Something isn't great about it. I can't think of that for Rear Window, so it's fine. It's fine. Mm. Anyway, that's all I mean. But thank you for writing in.
Thank you for writing in.
And seriously, always take us to task, by God. Do not let us get big heads. Yeah. Do not let us get big heads. But anyway, thank you so much for you and everyone else who wrote in. If we didn't get your email this week, we're sorry. We never have time to catch up on everything, but we love getting your emails. It means a lot to us to get your emails. We might read it next time. Feel free to send it again. If you want to send us something that's like time sensitive for any particular reason, feel free to reach out to Whitney on social media and just tell him to make a note of it.
Say, hey, you didn't read my letter yet. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, like, because we've had some people, hey, this is timed to the release of a thing or you know, it's for someone's birthday or whatever like that. Whatever. Just if there's something like that, please let us know so that we don't miss it.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, we just do our best. But in any case, if you want to write into a future episode of We've Got Mail, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. box? People who prefer to write in somehow.
Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yep. We're also on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
If you want other bonus shows from Critically Acclaimed, you can head on over to our Patreon. Patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. You can vote for future episodes. We have exclusive shows about Batman, Star Trek, the Academy Awards, tons of stuff over there at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Thank you to all of our patrons, without whom none of our shows would exist. They would all be gone. So we just cannot thank you enough. And if you can't afford to subscribe on our Patreon, please subscribe just in general. Tell a friend. Leave us a review if you can. It really, really helps. Head on over to our soap store, me and M. Lapis Da Silva. We run a soap store called Salt Cat Soap. It's on social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at Salt Cat Soap. And it's on Etsy. You can find the link on our social media. But yeah, we sell craft designer soaps. We're doing a big push. We got a lot of new cool stuff coming out for the holidays. We got a lot of Halloween soaps currently in the store. We're going to be making another batch of our glow-in-the-dark ghost soaps, which we cannot keep in stock, which is really great. Thank you, everybody who's bought them. But we'll also be doing stuff for, you know, the winter season as well, Christmas and other related activities. Not all Christmas, but, you know, seasonal. So thank you very much for that. Please check that out if you haven't already. It'd be nice. You don't have to. I get it. I think that's it.
That's it.
Are we good? Okay, great. So thank you, everybody, once again. Have a great week. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.